This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we call the show Main Street because, like the times we gather on those main streets, we're meeting friends, we're having good conversations, maybe talking about our jobs, our vacations, maybe some kind of great adventure that happened on a vacation. And here today is a tale that is worth repeating. We are going to learn about the 1914 expedition of a treacherous river deep in the Amazon. And joining me now by phone is John Maggio. He is the writer, producer, and director of Into the Amazon, which is airing in January on PBS stations. John, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Ashley.
Into the Amazon. Like I said, we are talking about a river deep in the Amazon, previously unexplored. So I want to start right away with a trailer to this film.
What Roosevelt wanted was to test himself against nature.
This is a guy who likes physical danger.
They are running out of food. They're running out of time.
Roosevelt says, this is it. You have to leave me here.
Into the Amazon on American Experience.
Well, that was 1/10 25 seconds. And I tell you, I read the 4-page press release, and I have never in my life read a more thrilling press release on a film. John, set us up. Who are the key players in this mission?
Well, in 1914, a couple of years, about 16 months after Theodore Roosevelt lost his bid for a third term as president, he was somebody who liked to, when he was feeling down, kind of go on an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1913, he had gotten an invitation, actually from Argentina, to come down and do a speaking tour. And at the time, his status in South America and Latin America was not so great. They saw, many leaders there saw him as an imperialist because of the Panama Canal and some of the other things that he was doing around the world as president. So for him, even just going down there to speak was going to be an adventure. But he saw it as an opportunity to maybe do some exploring, maybe go down the Paraguay River and see some exotic animals, do some hunting and collecting for the Natural History Museum here in New York that he was a big donator to. He'd been on safaris in Africa. Anyways, all of that seemed pretty pleasant and an interesting experience for him that he was planning to do. But when he got down to Rio de Janeiro and he met Brazil's greatest living explorer, a man named Candido Rondon, the plans totally changed because what Rondon did was challenge him to actually go on a real expedition. He gave Theodore Roosevelt the chance to explore a previously unexplored river called, and it was only known as the Rio da Dúvida, which is, in English is the River of Doubt. And that was, I think that Theodore Roosevelt just wanted to step up to the challenge. And it had unbelievable consequences because he really had no idea what he was getting into. It was an incredibly treacherous river adventure that he was not prepared for. And even so, even when the original trip, a sort of much lighter kind of, you know, journey through the Amazon wilderness had been planned, Theodore Roosevelt's wife is very worried about him going alone. So she enlisted their youngest son, second oldest son, rather, Kermit Roosevelt, to accompany Theodore Roosevelt on this trip because she was, as she said, she thought Theodore Roosevelt was in a reckless frame of mind. So those are the three main characters in the film, Kermit Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, and the Brazilian explorer Candido Rondon.
So we've got words like reckless, treacherous, greatest explorer.
I know. It really is. It's from a period in time that has, yeah, I'll say two things. The Amazon is still, I think, the last frontier. I mean, you know, we've pushed the boundaries and continue to push the boundaries of science and our understanding of the world. But in terms of physical geography, where people travel, that is still, you know, there are still uncontacted tribes living in the Amazon. And so in 1914, I mean, it felt like Theodore Roosevelt saw it as an opportunity to put his own flag on the map of the great explorers of the time. You know, we'd already sort of we've discovered Antarctica and the North and South Poles had been conquered. And I think he saw this as his opportunity to put his name on the map, which, by the way, it is.
He did, yeah. Today.
It's called the Rio Roosevelt. He did accomplish that, but at what cost?
Well, what are those costs? What happened on this mission?
Well, what they didn't, you know, Candido Rondon, who was sort of the embodiment of Lewis and Clark. I mean, he understood the Amazon jungle better than any man alive. He had been on a project to send a telegraph wire from Rio de Janeiro all the way through the Amazon to the far western region of the Amazon. So he understood how to get through and how to live off the land, and kind of really sort of understood the people that also inhabited the rainforest. But he was used to living Spartanly. So to get to the headwaters of the River of Doubt took about a 29-30 day journey through some of the thickest jungle that anybody has ever experienced. I mean, and they're encountering people for the first time, and having to sort of negotiate with Indians. And when Roosevelt and his team had gone down there, they had way overplanned, and they had lots of material, food like bacon and wine and chocolates and all these things that just could not be hauled through the wilderness, through the Amazon. So they had to scuttle all that. So by the time they get to the headwaters, a month after they set off, they're, you know, hacking their way through the jungle, malaria has set in, dysentery has set in, everyone is deathly ill, and their rations are almost completely gone. Rondon is fine because he's used to living this way, but all of the Americans seemed like they were on their last leg, and they still had about a 600-mile journey down a river they knew nothing about.
Oh, my gosh.
And that river turned out to be filled with rapids, and they had to take a number of different portages around rapids. At one point, one of the men that Rondon had hired to help them get down the river was drowned to death. Later on, when they were so famished, some of the men, they were called camaradas, they were native Brazilians, one of them committed a murder. Then Roosevelt got a leg infection, and he lost about 60 pounds and was feverish. And actually, at one point, which is a sort of one of the most important moments of the film, he actually asks his son to just leave him there, to just leave him behind. He just could not go on. And this is a man who had conquered so many terrains in so many different parts of the world that for him to be on his knees begging to be left behind, you get a sense of how treacherous this trip was.
You are filming this close to on location. This is more than 100 years later. How remote is this area? You were shooting mostly in Brazil. In parts, you had to go to the Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. How remote is this area still, even now, more than 100 years later?
Well, today, it's still on the far western edge of the Amazon, of the Brazilian Amazon. And it is still very, very remote, very hard to get to. There's one sort of international base. It's a birding sanctuary, and it's very small. There's almost nothing. To get there requires charter flights, and it's incredibly remote. The other issue there that Roosevelt confronted, this expedition confronted, was that the Cinta Larga people who control that whole area has actually gotten quite violent. Because of forest, diamond, and gold mining and things. They're very territorial. It's very difficult to actually even get rights to go on that part of the river. So it is really extremely remote. So that said, we made a decision after scouting that we should probably shoot somewhere where we could have a little bit of control, that because we were bringing in about 20 people, a 20-person crew with hundreds of thousands of dollars of camera equipment and, you know, things like that. So we ended up shooting about 3 hours up the Rio Negro on a tributary of the Rio Negro called the Ariu River, which had many of the same qualities of the actual River of Doubt. The black water, very still. It was a flooded forest. It was very serpentine. All the same wildlife, caiman and anaconda and all the things that Roosevelt experienced, we were able to do that there. So it was quite remote, but it was we could be a helicopter flight back to Manaus if we ran into any problems. So, yes, and I think the feel of the film is that. I mean, it feels, you know, you can't recreate. There's no way to recreate the breadth and the depth of the Amazon basin. I mean, it's, you know, the size of the lower 48 states of this country. I mean, it's just massive.
Right. Yeah, how much time did you spend on location almost just feeling overwhelmed?
Oh, my gosh. So, we were there for weeks. And, you know, we shot many interviews in Rio. So we had sort of gotten that under our belts. And we came back and kind of cut the film together as a sort of story. You know, it's generally how I work. I get the story down here. I get all my voices together. And then we went to the Amazon for about 3 weeks, I think. And it was about 10 days total of shooting. Once we, you know, you have to scout around and make sure you get all your locations really locked down there because the river was flooded, which is what we wanted. And it rains every day. Every day at any given hour, it will just suddenly open up and pour on you. So you have to plan very scheduled, very sort of controlled. And, you know, you have all this camera equipment floating just inches above this water. And we were fortunate to have an incredible team of Brazilians working with us, many of them indigenous to that area that we were in. So they had, you know, remedies for us if anybody got sick in the stomach or there was one point at which, you're not going to believe this, but one of the animal wranglers we had brought a sloth down from a tree and it actually grabbed onto the arm of my drone cameraman, Brian Harvey, and wouldn't let go of his arm. And it took about three of these guys to pry the sloth's claws from his arms. And I was very worried that he was going to get a deep infection in that particular wound.
Wow.
And but the locals had these incredible remedies. They had, you know, picked some beans from some of the trees that it was a paste that had kind of, you know, some kind of a disinfectant quality to it. So it was things like that kept happening. And so what I began to realize very quickly is that it was as if I was on my own River of Doubt expedition. It felt very it brought me so much closer to the story. You know, I knew I wanted to shoot it in the Brazilian Amazon, but being with these guys, because it was ultimately in our storytelling, it was those guys that actually saved the day and helped Roosevelt actually get out of the Amazon. So
yeah, there would have been no way to do this without indigenous knowledge.
No, absolutely not, absolutely not. And you know, and so today, you know, the Amazon still is very remote. I mean, it really is not developed very much at all. We stayed in this place that that Jacques Cousteau had originally tried to develop into a place for people to come and study the Amazon. So he built a kind of platform to call it a hotel would be very generous, but it's more just like a compound on stilts above the water on the Rio Negro. And so we were suspended by that, but it has not been updated in about 40 years. So it was really just a shelter to be above the water where we could bring in generators and sort of do our things. There's just not much there. You know, people still live very simply, and they don't have a lot of, you know, they're river people, so the river is really their highway. It was fascinating to see.
We are visiting with John Maggio. He is the writer, producer, and director of Into the Amazon. It's coming up on January 9th on PBS stations. It is part of the American Experience series, and it details the journey down the River of Doubt, now called the Roosevelt River. This is the expedition of Theodore Roosevelt and Brazilian explorer Candido Rondon as they are making this perilous journey down this previously unmapped river. John, you mentioned, of course, that this kind of undertaking involves just a ton of research. How long did it take you before you even got to start filming this?
Yes, that's a really good question. I mean, it probably, you know, I think all told, the production schedule was about 18 or 19 months, which is quite long. I mean, it's a two-hour film. So I usually spend about 3 months of what I call pre-production, of just kind of getting my arms around the story. A lot of the film is told through the journals of Theodore Roosevelt that he took at the time. He was writing, as he was often did when he went on an expedition, he would contract with Scribner's Magazine to kind of write about the adventure. So he was keeping very detailed notes in his journal. And his son Kermit also kept a journal. Kermit, it should be noted, had just been engaged to a woman named Belle Willard, whose family owns the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C., a very prominent family at the time. And the last place he wanted to be was buried in the Brazilian Amazon. So he kept he would write letters to her, and so we had those letters. And then there was an American naturalist named George Cherry, a quite famous naturalist, who was a sort of like Indiana Jones-like character. He was also one of the Americans that traveled with Roosevelt, and he kept a very detailed journal. So a lot of it was about calling all of that material together and kind of stitching it, because I wanted those voices to populate the film throughout. So you get the kind of intimate sense that you're on the journey with them, and that just takes a lot of time. And what I try to do is create get all of my extant materials and archival together, and then I put together a shooting script. That takes about 6 months, and then I go and shoot interviews and sort of, you know, really learn from the experts who know this story. And then you just keep building upon it. It's a really iterative process. And you really don't want to shoot a frame of recreation footage until you really know what you're trying to illuminate. Because, you know, film is, as you can imagine, very expensive, that whole process.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned speaking to experts who know this story. One of those experts is North Dakota's own Clay Jenkinson. You hear him on this station. He is the voice of Thomas Jefferson during the Thomas Jefferson Hour. He is also very knowledgeable about Theodore Roosevelt, the author of A Free and Hardy Life, Theodore Roosevelt's Sojourn in the American West, and Theodore Roosevelt in the Dakota Badlands, and historical guide. How did you find your experts?
Well, it's weirdly a very narrow sliver of people who actually know much about this story. One of them is interesting, was a man named Joseph Ornig, who is a writer, and he had written a book called My Last Chance to Be a Boy. And it was about this adventure. That was something that was taken from a quote that Theodore Roosevelt, I think, had written in one of his journals, that this was his last chance to be a boy.
And he was 55 at the time.
Yeah, exactly. 55 and about 55 pounds overweight. Ornig had done a lot of work on George Cherry's journals and really was one of the first people to kind of piece together the whole story. So I knew he was going to be invaluable. And then just to understand Theodore Roosevelt as something more than just an archetype, you know, because we've come to know Theodore Roosevelt as the swashbuckling, rough rider guy, wanted to get deeper than that. And that's when I encountered some of Clay's writing. And he was one of the first people we spoke to. Actually, we had him here in New York, and we had lunch, and I just, you know, he's so incredibly knowledgeable that it was an honor to be speaking to him. And then I ended up filming Clay in Chicago. You'd have to ask him, but it was like a 7-hour interview. I mean, he just is so knowledgeable, and his depth of understanding of Theodore Roosevelt's character is unparalleled. So it was a major find for me, and he is, you know, in the film you'll see he's everywhere. Clay seems to pop up at the most important moments.
The film, again, is called Into the Amazon. And obviously, when we're talking about a mission that is fraught with malaria and murder and waterfalls and rapids and abandonment and drowning, we have to talk about the adventure of that. But also, does the film go into the politics of the time? You mentioned near the top of this interview that Roosevelt wasn't necessarily well-received in South America.
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, we don't dwell too much on globally on his political views, but where it really comes in stark relief in our storytelling is his relationship with native peoples. It's interesting to note that Brazil at this time is going through its own kind of manifest destiny, and we're talking, you know, a few decades after we did it in North America, you know, when we sort of forded across the West and built the railroads and kind of reached out to the West. Brazil was living that at this time in 1914. That was part of what Candido Rondon was laying this telegraph line for. But he had a very different philosophy about how you treat indigenous people, and that's something we deal with. He believed that you don't relocate them. This is their land. If you can, you bring them modernity. You treat them as equals. They are part of the Brazilian nation, and we should learn from them. It was a very, very subtle approach Some might say naive, but ultimately that was the way Brazilians viewed their expansion west. Contrast that against Roosevelt, who was just a man of his time, but he believed that Indians, Native Americans, were wards of the state, and you know, should be become Americans and go to school and do all of the things and be relocated, and that was their land. It was part of Manifest Destiny. He was very much part of, and you know, we can only judge him on, he was a man of his times. You know, that's how we have to understand Roosevelt, and I don't claim to understand it any differently than that. But seen through our lens, of course, it seems quite stark. But for my purposes, that was about as deep politically as we went, because it served the story, because they kept encountering Native peoples in the Amazon, and their approach was very different. It really surprised Roosevelt that even when shot at by Native peoples, Candido Rondon didn't retaliate. He would play music and actually put opera on. He had Puccini records, and he had an old vitrola, and in the middle of the forest, he would put on Puccini, and he would tempt the natives back as just out of their natural curiosity. And then he would play with their children, and he'd speak to their adults, and they would trade for manioc flour, and he just integrated himself in this really incredibly seamless way. It was violent and dangerous, but he was just a really special person, and it dictated to even to this day how Brazilians treat the indigenous people.
How is Candido Rondon thought of today in Brazil? I imagine.
Oh, he's
well.
A legend. He is an absolute legend.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a whole area known as the Upper Xingu. It's the northern part of the Amazon where if there are, there's, you know, this is still a matter of debate. How many? It's hard to know. Uncontacted tribes there still are today, but if they exist, they exist largely in that region because they are absolutely protected. I actually recently saw a little piece of documentary evidence of some Peruvian Amazonian Indians wanting to come over and be on the Brazilian side because they had heard that they're treated better on the Brazilian side of the Amazon. So there's a network, that's an understanding that's where you want to be as an indigenous person, and that is a testament to Rondon today. There's the whole area of the Western Amazon where the Rio Roosevelt is now called Rondonia. In honor of him. So I believe he may even be on their money. He's a very beloved character, a hero.
How did you get into filmmaking?
Oh, yeah, in a very backward way. I had been a musician in Los Angeles. I had a record deal. I started making music videos around that time. So I got into the kind of film part. I should back up. Prior to that, I'd been a journalist in Washington. And so it's a weird progression of combining the journalism with filmmaking and the sort of creativity that I've always had. And I just parlayed that into a documentary film career. I'd always wanted to be a documentary filmmaker, but, you know, life takes you in these very weird routes. But I didn't think to study it. I didn't go to film school. It wasn't until I left Los Angeles, moved back to New York, that I got deeply into documentary film. That was about 16 years ago.
Well, this film is called Into the Amazon. It is part of PBS's American Experience. It premieres on PBS stations on Tuesday, January 9th. My guest, John Maggio, is the writer, producer, and director of Into the Amazon. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Ashley. I really liked it.
Coming up on Main Street, the history of antibiotics in the meat industry. And we'll also hear from Hukun Abdullahi. He is a recipient of the Fargo-Moorhead Human Relations Award. But now it's time for the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The man accused in the kidnapping and death of 22-year-old Savannah Graywind intends to take his chances with a jury. 38-year-old William Hain of Fargo is charged with murder, conspiracy, kidnapping, and giving police false information. His girlfriend, 32-year-old Brooke Cruz, faces identical charges and is scheduled to change her plea to guilty on Monday. Hain is represented by attorney Daniel Borgen of Bismarck.
Your Honor, we would like to set this on for jury selection and trial. As far as scheduling goes, have had talks with the assistant state's attorney on this. We would like a date certain after February.
A February date or a March date?
We already have a trial scheduled in Williston for 2 weeks in February, so I would prefer it be March, the first week of March or after.
Graywin disappeared from her North Fargo apartment last summer. She was pregnant. Her newborn daughter was found in an apartment shared by Hain and Cruz in the same building. Graywin's body was later found wrapped in plastic in the Red River. The legislature has decided to hire its own budget consultant. The Legislative Revenue Advisory Committee hired HIS Market. The consultant will be paid $49,000. This comes on the heels of the state's Office of Management and Budget re-upping with Moody's Analytics for help in crafting the executive budget. Some lawmakers criticized Moody's for missing the mark in its revenue forecast. This was originally in the legislature's budget bill. Governor Doug Burgum used his line item veto on it, but the attorney general found that the veto wasn't valid. House Majority Leader Al Carlson and Senate Appropriations Committee Chairman Ray Holmberg say it comes down to the legislature to make the decisions on spending.
This puts our eyes directly on the budget process and the revenue side, and that was the intent of it. It wasn't to pick a fight, but we think that we need to, from our perspective, be gathering information, working with someone, and using that information as we go into balance the budget.
Because at the end of the day, we're responsible, because we have to accept the numbers.
State Budget Director Pam Sharp says her office has a good relationship with Moody's and that forecasting firms shouldn't shoulder all the blame for missing some of the revenue projections. And Senator Heidi Heitkamp says she has voted in favor of confirming Kristen Nielsen as the new Secretary of Homeland Security. Heitkamp says she voted to confirm Nielsen for two reasons. She says Nielsen is committed to carrying through a real strategy on both the U.S.'s southern and northern borders. She's also an expert on security when it comes to cyber threats.
That is her unique expertise. We spent a lot of time talking about what we need to do in order to build a better, more resilient policy for cybersecurity. And so I think she is the right person for the job. I look forward to working with her.
Heitkamp says she has a unique relationship with Nielsen due to her presence on the Committee for Homeland Security and Government Affairs, which has jurisdiction over the Department of Homeland Security. She says she wants to bring Nielsen to North Dakota at some point to get her a firsthand look at the state's unique border issues. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Mansour Omari spent time in secret Syrian prisons where he was tortured and starved.
You turn into a skeleton inside and your skin is covered with wounds. We never saw the sun for 9 months.
Now he's sharing stories from the inside that he wrote in his own blood. We have that story plus the aftermath of a presidential announcement on Jerusalem on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Most of the major poultry producers in the United States have stopped using antibiotics in chicken feed. That's in part because giving fewer antibiotics is thought to be a way to protect humans from drug-resistant diseases. Maren McKenna calls it a moment of change. She's the author of the new book, Big Chicken. Harvest Public Media brings us an excerpt of an interview between McKenna and KCUR's Steve Kraske, host of Up to Date. They talk about the history of antibiotics in the meat industry.
Maren, when did this practice of dishing up all these antibiotics to chickens begin back in the day? When did all this start?
The fascinating thing, and I didn't know this until I started researching this, is that all of this begins right as antibiotics come on the scene. So a little bit of history. Probably in, you know, high school biology, people learned about Alexander Fleming, who in 1928 left a window open in his laboratory in London, and something blew in the window and killed the plates of bacteria that he was working on. And that thing that killed them was a compound excreted by a mold that had come in through the window. That compound became the first antibiotic, penicillin. But not until the 1940s. It took Fleming and his collaborators a while to actually develop it into a drug. So penicillin comes out in the midst of World War II and really makes a difference to the war in about 1943, and the other drugs that start the antibiotic era all by 1948, all just being used in humans. And then in 1948, one of the manufacturers of one of those drugs gets the idea that maybe they could also find a market for their drugs in animals. And simultaneously, the food system is kind of suffering from the end of the war, because during the war, of course, there'd been a huge guaranteed market to all the soldiers and sailors deployed across the world. When that market goes away, the meat production system needs to cut costs to keep from having its economy crash entirely. And so they start feeding animals cheaper feed and they need supplements to make the feed more nutritious. And one of the scientists at that company that makes one of the first antibiotics gets the idea to try the leftovers from their manufacturing of their antibiotic in the animal's feed. And when he weighs the chicks that are his experimental animals, chickens are the first ones to get these growth promoter antibiotics, he discovers that the ones that got the tiny antibiotic doses gained more than twice as much weight as birds that had not gotten a supplement at all. And out of that, this whole worldwide industry of giving antibiotics routinely to meat animals was born. Within 5 years, American farmers were giving...
These antibiotics have this upside, which is what you're leading to here, I think, is it makes chicken awfully, awfully cheap.
That's right. It made animals, chicken first, and then very quickly these antibiotics were given to pigs as well, and then it took a while longer before they were trialed in cattle. They made it possible to grow an animal more quickly. So you could either give the same amount of feed and get the animal through lesser feed for the same amount of time or the same amount of feed and get the animal out faster. One way or another, it started people thinking about birds first and then other animals as something that you could move rapidly through a production system, almost like an assembly line for cars.
Yeah.
And from that, we get the concentration of farming. We get much larger barns and much larger feedlots. We get all the things that together have contributed to our protein being extremely, maybe artificially, inexpensive.
And yet, scientists were warning even right from the start that all these antibiotics might not be a good thing. What were some of them saying?
You know, this is the kind of the heartbreaking thing about this story is that there were warnings right at the beginning. In fact, even before that first experiment in 1948, Alexander Fleming, the discoverer of penicillin, had said in 1945, when he accepted the Nobel Prize, that if we underdosed people with antibiotics, then resistant bacteria would result and would undermine the action of these precious drugs. Now, Fleming didn't know it, but what he was describing was exactly what agriculture was going to start doing, which was underdosing animals for some purpose other than curing an infection.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration between stations covering America's food and rural issues. Coming up on Main Street, a Human Relations Award.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Maestro Amaya, presents their annual Holiday Pops Concert on Saturday, December 9th at 7:30 p.m. at MSU's Ann Nicole Nelson Hall. The orchestra will be joined by choirs from Minot State University, Minot High School, and Our Redeemer's Christian School, and will feature seasonal music from American, British, Italian, French, and Russian composers. Tickets are available online at MinotSymphony.com or by calling 701-858-4228.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. The Fargo Human Relations Commission works to promote acceptance and respect for diversity and discourages all forms of discrimination. The Human Relations Award goes to people and organizations dedicated to that mission. This year, the Youth Award goes to Hukun Abdullahi, director of the Afro-American Development Association. One of his primary focuses is to help new Americans overcome language and technology barriers to find meaningful work. He's Madeline's guest on this week's Prairie Pulse.
Tell first just about yourself, your background, where you're from originally, and how you got to Fargo-Moorhead.
My name is Hukun Abdullahi, and originally I was born in Somalia, and then I came to Fargo-Moorhead in 2014 to reunite with my mom, who was here, whom we have not met for more than 10 years. And she filed for us a visa, and that is how I came to Fargo-Moorhead area. I came February 2014. It was very cold. And that is the time I arrived here, but I was born in Somalia, raised by my grandma, and then moved to Kenya. And then that is the time that our mom filed for us a visa to come to the state. I stayed in Nairobi, Kenya, for a while. And then and I went to school there, then came to Fargo-Moorhead.
So we'll get into what you're involved with here, but to be apart from your mother for 10 years, that must have been very difficult.
Yeah, it's been very difficult. Though my grandma was our mom, she was our dad, she was our mentor, she was everything for us. you know, how to respect your elders and everybody. That's how we have been raised by our grandma.
Well, tell us about the Afro-American Development Association that you helped start here. Tell us about what is that about?
Actually, when I arrived in 2014, February, and, you know, it was very cold, and we faced a lot of challenges when it comes to the weather, when it comes to going to school, when it comes to getting for it. It's kind of like starting new life. And actually, I didn't come here as a refugee. My mom filled out for us everything, paid everything. Right. And she was the one who was giving us orientation and all that. And the moment we arrive, and I get a lot of orientation from her. Like, I can give you an example. When you're driving a car, in Kenya, it's like you'll come out from the car when police stop you. And the first thing she said was, when police stop you, stay in the car. If you come out, you'll be shot. That was the orientation I get it from her. But the reason why we started Afro-American Development Association was I speaking a little bit English, facing those challenges, language barrier, you know, kind of like not getting the accent well and all that. What about the ones who don't speak the language? And then I went to M State and met a friend called Yunis Amin, who is my co-founder, and we were going same class, math class in M State. Then we talked about and we discussed all those, what can we do to help, you know, the refugee population in Fargo-Moorhead area. So we were discussing all this every day and discussing about the challenges we were facing. And we came up with forming the Afro-American Student Association. And then we expanded. We invited the other students in M State who were immigrant. And we invited other students from NDSU and MSUM. They came. And so we discussed about we need to have an office. And that's where we started first. And then we got the office. Everybody paid $1,500. Like, it was installment that we paid. We get the office, paid the rent for 1 year, and bought some stationeries and chair and desk, which was there, which still we have that desk and chair that we started with. And then we invited the community, whoever want help, looking for a job, fill out for application, everything, please welcome. And we started, and then we divided ourselves, going to everywhere we can get resources for our community. So we were almost 10 students, and then every week everybody has to report back where they reach, where they get resources. And then we disseminate the resources we get to our new American families so that they know that where they can get there. So that's how we started. And then later, and some of our friends whom we started with the organization graduated from the universities, and we changed the name from Afro-American Student Association to Afro-American Development Association, since we were doing a lot of development issues in the community. And somewhere 2015 September, rural Minnesota Concentrated Employment Program in Clay County. Mm-hmm. They are kind of like Minnesota workforce. I went there and I met with a Minnesota Deeds business specialist, and he introduced me to SEP, the Rural Minnesota Concentrated Employment Program. And then we created a pilot project called New Americans Workforce Employer Workforce Education, which was training the new Americans on job readiness, financial literacy, and also how to ride the MART bus in town. Since some of them, they don't have a car, so what is the other ways that they can we can solve the transportation side? So we started now training them how to ride the MART bus in town. And we started the project. They sent to us 10 new American, and then we trained the 10 new American on 45 hours. After they finished the 45 hours, we placed them to job. That was the successful project we did. So we trained on job readiness, how to build their resume. We prepared them on how to retain their job, tips of interview and all that. And immediately they graduated from the 45 hours class, we placed them to job. That was the successful part we did. And the other things we came up was we have elders in town. Like, actually our elders, like back home, they used to be important people. Like, they used to solve disputes and domestic violence and all that. But here, when they came, there's nothing called like that. You have to follow the law and order. Right. So what we did was, how can we use the wise or the wisdom of our elders, you know, bring them the ideas, and at least they can work with the police and all that. So we initiated a project called Introducing Somali Council of Elders, which was how they can work with the Morehead Police Department. Mm-hmm. and we met with the police chief, David Ebinger, and then we discussed about him, we shared with him, and this is the way that the community can work with the police, and right. so they don't see the police being like the way right. back home, and we can build relationship there. We met, and then we told him about the elders, and he was excited about it. So we said, you know, if the police can do training to the community, to the elders, and then the elders can educate the community about the police and what they do and how they, like when they have an issue, how they can call the police. So we started training. The police chief had a, there was a new American liaison officer who used to come to our training, train the Somali Council of Elders mm-hmm. about the American police and all that, and he used to train them every month, every 4 months once, and then they train the community, which we built a relationship there that when the community now they need help, like if anything happened to them, they don't have to call me now. They can call Sergeant Stafford immediately. That's right. the relationship we built. And also I'm participating now the Citizens Police Academy too, learning about the police issues. So that is the first and the second mm-hmm. project we did. And so I used to work two jobs. I used to go to school and I also volunteer in the organization with other friends was like that too. They work like two jobs or one job and go to school. That is how we say like I can volunteer like 2 hours a day or 3 hours a day. The other one they can volunteer 2 hours or 3 hours or 1 hour. So that is how we kind of like give ourselves a time that our office will be open always. So although nobody has been paid at that time, but this is how we can help our community. And then there was another organization that reached out to us. It was called MET Inc. It was a Motivational Education Training Inc. They're based in Fargo. They reached out to us and they say they have trainings that they can do for the new Americans. And the training was how they can get commercial driving license, how they can get forklift certificate, how they can get welding certificate. Then we invited our community there in our small office. And then almost more than 100 people showed up. And then now they started registering. And I think at that time, so we referred to them almost 60 new American who get commercial driver license, who get forklift certificate, who get welding certificate. That is how we started the organization, and we initiated all those projects to help the new American population to fully integrate and thrive in this community.
And you got a Fargo Human Relations Award too. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So I was being nominated by the community here in Fargo Moorhead, and they nominated our organization, and that is how I got the award. They nominated because of what we were doing in the community.
And tell us about this New American Job Fair that you created.
One day, and a lady, I think she was from the Moorhead Business Association, and she saw an article in the news in the forum, and she sent me an email. She said, hello, Hukun, I see there's a lot of issues in the New American. Will you mind if you come and speak to our morning breakfast show? And then I say, sure, let me come. And then I went there. It was morning time. I'm not a morning guy, but I pulled up my socks and went there. And then I went to the morning breakfast show. And then there was a business leaders, CEOs sitting there. And then I shared the challenges that the new Americans are facing. And from there, they said, how can we help? And then say, we can do New American Job Fair, which was bringing the employers and the new Americans together so that the employers will learn about the new Americans, because there's a lot of gaps. Somebody who has been in refugee camp for 20 years, never worked, never did anything, and then they came here. They don't have work experience.
Right.
So what is the ways that they can get? There's a gap there. What is the ways that they can get experience? What, you know, we wanted the employers to learn about who these new people they're dealing with. And so we, the Moorhead Business Association and the First Congregational Church of Moorhead, Michelle Weber, so we came together and what is the ways we can invite the employers and what is the ways that they can hire the new Americans. Then we expanded, we invited the Minnesota Workforce, which is the rural Minnesota SEP. And then we invited, now we have open a job service of North Dakota too, which is part of the New American Job Fair. So that's how we expanded. And the main reason was building connection between the new Americans and the employers. And We did last year and this year too, so we'll be doing tomorrow. Tomorrow is the we'll have a new American job fair from 10 to 1 o'clock, which I think right now we have almost 14 companies who show interest that they are coming, and the community also, they will come. And, you know, our community feel like, why will I go to job fair? I know I will not be hired. But what we did was we said, if you go to a job fair, you'll meet with HR, you'll build connection there, you can get their business card. You know, like the moment they see, when you apply job, you call them and say, hey, you know, we met at the New American Job Fair and applied job. Is there a possible way you can have an interview with me? Or what is the ways I can do? It's kind of like building a relationship and connection mm-hmm. there so that they can learn about who the New Americans are. That is what we want to do.
Why do you think the refugee resettlement New American issue has become kind of a hot button issue in the last couple of years in Fargo-Moorhead? Do you have any reasons for this, and does it concern you?
It concerns me because these people, they came to the United States to seek for hope, you know, to change their lives. The reason why they left their country is because of dictatorship and, you know, like they ran away with their life. They seek refuge here. If it turned away like this, what is next for them? So it disturbs me, and it disturbs not only me, it disturbs also a lot of people, refugees who are in the community. Because when you hear you're going to United States, what you feel was always like you feel hope, you know, like I'm going to the land of opportunity, and my life will going to change, you know, I'll go to work, I'll go to further my education. This is what refugees feel when they are in refugee camp, and when they have been told you're going to the state. But now refugee who is in Dadaab refugee camp or Kakuma refugee camp, that hope they have now died, because the reason why it's dead because of what is happening now. It is actually things that it's worsening now. And United States was one of the world police and who enforces democracy in each country. And now it's showing kind of like it's turning from 360 degrees to, I don't know, because the way they used to do now, it's changing a lot. And so what will happen to other countries who never practiced democracy, who had dictators? So what will they do if the United States, the world police, turn this way? So they will continue to oppress the people, and then they don't have a place to go. And the place they used to feel hope, turning this way. The refugee resettlement in Fargo-Moorhead area, what I feel like it is turning to be political, like the way nationally mm-hmm. Turn out to be. And if you see the city council side, if you see the state side, so they want to use the tactics that the national use, that they want to get more people, that refugees are taking away our jobs, refugees, you know, are doing this. Which is not technically, it's not that. Refugees are taking jobs that are not filled
right.
by the locals, like housekeeping jobs, which locals, they don't go and do it. That is the jobs they are taking. And there is a lot of refugees who have masters, who have degrees, and still working on the line. They don't care about the degrees they have. They came here to change their life. There is once I know that they have they graduated from NDSU, they have degrees, they have masters, and they're still working on the line. They are not getting the job that when they go into school, that this is the job I'll be getting. They're not getting those jobs. They're still on the job they have started.
About a minute left. What are you studying? What are you going to do with your degree when you're done?
And I'll be going to MSUM to do project management. And what I'm seeking for is... I don't know. I'll go into work with this organization for a little bit while if my board say you can continue a job, or I'll look for any other job that I think would be better for me.
Prairie Pulse airs at 7:30 Central, 6:30 Mountain on the television service of Prairie Public. This week's show will also feature a piece on an accomplished woodworker. Dakota Datebook is next.
The Bismarck Mandan Civic Chorus opens its 40th season with the North Dakota Christmas on Saturday, December 9th at 7:30 and Sunday, December 10th at 4 p.m. at the Cathedral of the Holy Spirit in Bismarck. The concert features familiar carols from The Little Drummer Boy to Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, as well as guest appearances by local children's choirs and North Dakota troubadour Chuck Suki. The concert is free and open to the public. The Bismarck Mandan Civic Chorus, your community, your chorus. More information can be found online at bismanchorus.com.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 6th. On this date in 1914, most news took a backseat to election results as North Dakota newspapers were full of articles about the vote held the day before. The Washburn Leader reported that two more states had voted for prohibition, bringing the total of dry states to 13. The Pioneer Express of Pembina announced a Republican sweep from ocean to ocean. The Golden Valley Chronicle announced in a huge headline that Beach had won a vote to serve as the Golden Valley County seat. The Devil's Lake Interocean was also taken up with election results. One headline announced the success of the entire state Republican ticket. Another reported that the Democrats had held on to a majority in Congress, but by fewer seats. And one small article addressed a contentious topic of the day, women's suffrage. Women in Montana and Nevada had won the right to vote. With the addition of those two states, women could vote in 11 states and the territory of Alaska. North Dakota rejected women's suffrage, with 55% voting no. Readers who browsed further into the newspaper would have come across an interesting supplement sponsored by suffrage advocates. The page was titled, "The Day After." It stated, "It seems grossly unfair that we have to work so hard for the right of franchise when the men simply took the right." The article pointed out that men could come to the United States from other countries, and when they had become citizens, they had the right to vote. But women who had been born in this country and lived here all their lives were denied the same right. The vote was, of course, a temporary setback. The suffrage headquarters announced that campaigns would begin immediately in anticipation of the 1916 election, when women's suffrage would once again be an issue. Indeed, the next North Dakota legislative session in 1917 granted women the right to vote in state elections. And 3 years later, with the passage of the 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution, women secured the right to vote in national elections as well. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, ranchers and predators like wolves and bobcats are often at odds. Do they have to be? From the Food and Environment Reporting Network, writer Christina Johnson travels to Montana to report on predator coexistence. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.